Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. We're on page 172, chapter 44. Let's see how long this chapter is. Oh, this is the last chapter before we hit part two. We'll go on to chapter 45. Nice. All right. It was a distinguished poverty in which Brother Wilhelm Wittling had spent his last years on the top two floors of a thin, high-ribbed house on Essex Street. Sometimes in those waning, darkening, fog-bound years, when the skies were streaked with red and black, black veils of chimney smoke trailed over the busy harbor, as he dreamed that when his eyelet puncher and embroidery terrestrial machine received pecuniary reward, he might devote himself not only to his Venus or Moontrap celestial machine or as shown on his astronomical blueprint, but to the realization of his ever-abiding dream of a perpetual motion machine, one that when it was once started would come to no halt, no swift or slow or grinding halt, one that might even reproduce and give birth to a new part as a dead part died and fell off, and might realize also his dream of chimneys that might be taught to consume their own smoke and not darken all city lights. But he was hard-pressed to know where to get the money with which to pay for a bag of potatoes or a hogshead with which to feed his family. The bloody rule of the carpetbaggers, who are carrying so many of this nation's treasures and public lands away that they ought to have had carpets hanging from their mouths, could have come as no surprise to one who had remained under the spell of Robert Owens's messages to the Chartists, the starving miners and mill workers of England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. Wittling's sympathies remained those of a Fenian German, in fact, at a time when so many poor potato-faced Irish, and mainly they were the young, were coming into New York that some people thought it should be called New Cork, and certainly the gutters were rolling with them, who had not yet attained the status of the least curtain Irish, as probably most never would. In 1868, the former Alpine climber and perhaps only fleeting resurrection of Christ had suffered a most severe accident in a life that had suffered many somatic and psychic accidents, many wounds which had tried to heal as best he could, and that was a fall on his back on a jagged slab of ice when he had gone out to clear away piles of ice from the yard of his Essex Street home and had stubbed his big toe. There had been no soft feathering of snow to protect his head when he fell, but his head, which contained the refulgent flower of the many-lobed brain, which was the chief flower upon the stalk of his body, had not been injured. The only external suffering was that of another part, the big toe. A first doctor who was called in had washed away the blood of the wounded big toe and had advised rest so that the smashed jointure might knit itself, just hang in there onto the foot to which it belonged. But because of a virus causing the man to swell up so that it seemed he might burst, a second doctor had been called in, and feeling that there was a danger in waiting for time to heal this wound, for the patient might die before the wound was healed, had cut away the big toe with surgical shears and sewed together the sides of the hole where it had been with needle and thread. The loss of the big toe, which is a symbol of manhood, had crippled the star voyager as if he who from now on could walk only with the help of his stout cane upon a zigzag course had heard in this harbor a silent ship's bell silently heralding the approach of his death. His illnesses had immeasurably increased because of this accident, which did reduce his spirit to its lowest burning point as his body minus his big toe, which presumably returned to limbo and had left him with a crippled limb, had swollen up with the old king virus in all his mortal cells. The gallbladder trouble which, turning his skin from red to yellow to black to gray, like the great clouds forming around him, as his eyes grew dim and his eardrums seemed ready to burst, had affected his drainage pipes and had contributed to his suffering from many debilitating ills, of which he was his own best diagnostician. His wife, who had always had a strong sense of a rescue missionary character, and had followed with him through many snowstorms, had assisted this dying knight by placing over his wounded, breaking or broken heart, mustard poultices, and massaging his pain-racked body with its porous pores, from which the night sweats poured colder than the ice and snow in the frozen winter world, where the cry of the fox was frozen like the bark of a dog. He had continued to fight on and on for his sewing machine attachment rights, and had even offered to come to a compromise with the Singer Sewing Machine Company, which, however, would continue to hum on and on without payment to his widow and children when he had passed on to what was perhaps erroneously called his last reward. Great Caesars of sewing machines had triumphed in Gaul while he was left in Gaul and warm wood up to his mouth while pursuing his igis fatus as a thing more worthy of interest than worldly wealth. The true wealth was, in his view, spiritual and not material. So they have triumphed in Gaul, capital G-A-U-L, but the place as opposed to Gall Gate, G-A-L-L. That's what that means. And it's hard to tell in English when words sound the same. It was because of his fellow members of the Swan Brotherhood, Needle and Thread and Scissors and Pants and Coatsmen, and their Swan Sisters who had kept up his membership, that he, who had no more earthly goods to show for his life's work upon Utopia and the Automatic Eyelet Puncher, an Eyelash Embroiderer, and the Venus or Moon Trap, escaped being carried away by the dustmen into the potter's field of the broken clay pots, which were so many that they clogged the gutters and sewers and rivers of New York. A surely admirable example of human solidarity was that in which the journeyman tailors, joined together, were able to put their differences aside and join in harmony in celebration of funeral rites to make his passage from this world to the world yet to come. They had been able to pay out of their communal funds for the hearse horses and the hearse driver and the hearse with which to carry the fallen knight and his coffin under the coffin lid to the place where he was to be interred. Members of his family and union members following in a straggling line before there was much traffic to hold them up or even conceivably knock over the hearse and knock over the coffin and knock the corpse out, so they might get up and walk as did others in the city of the walking dead. The place where the sexton had dug up the clods for the grave with his shovel from Brother Vitlin's wife and his sister-in-law and his little daughter in their black pokes and black veils embroidered by machinery and his five sons. And the mourner swans had departed was in the impoverished, unfashionable section of the Greenwood Cemetery in the city of Brooklyn. Among the few American newspaper reporters giving notice of the passage of Wilhelm Vitling had been the New York Times obituary writer who had had a few tears to shed for Wilhelm Vitling, an inventor of prominence who had never received any benefit from his inventions and had left among his last effects his unfinished treatise on moon and sun and stars, the fruit of 14 years of mental toil, which competent star critics had declared interesting and worthy of commendation. The New York Beltristicious Journal had given star billing to the lately departed Utopian tailor, but for this obituary writer, Brother Vitling was evidently an archetype, the original pattern after which a thing was formed and which would have its imitators. The editor seemed to be determined that to the forgotten man should be given remembrance, at least for a fleeting moment. Wilhelm Vitling, he wrote, is the name of a forgotten man, one of the many who, after a stormy career abroad, became lost and were forgotten and found their last resting place in America, where they were confused by their own theories. Germany had forgotten Wilhelm Vitling long ago. Only the long-departed Heinrich Heine, one may remember that the dying Heine, the ghost of his father whirling around him, like the Holy Ghost as he had lain on his pallet stuck by needles and pins causing his increase of sufferings, as this present Elegiast for Vitling did not recall. Elegiast? For Vitling did not recall, thus not mixing one elegy for one man with another elegy for another man, had once directed attention for a fleeting moment to the philosophical tailor, the gifted thinker, the founder of German communism. Das Evangelium des armen Sünders, Gospel of the Poor Sinner, as the English would say, deserved to be brought out again in print that all might read who had eyes. Perhaps the obituary writer should have called the book a booklet, as it had been written by the man who was to be an eyelet man. But Wilhelm Vitling lost his following after the fiasco of the Arbiterverein and the Utopian colony at Communia. Men ceased to believe in him, and the waves tossed him upon the beach. Throw no stone at him, for he proved to be a man amidst the storms of life, and his driving motive was something higher than ambition and selfishness. Further along in the Gilded Age, Marx was to describe, in a letter dated October 19, 1877, to Representative Sorge, which would reach him in his garden in Hoboken, when the last of the gilded leaves had fallen in the soughing winter wind, the decades it had taken to sweep utopian socialism out of German workers' heads so that they might be as theoretically and practically free as the French and the English. But now it seemed that what had been swept out by the tide had been swept back in by the tide. The concern of Marx had been with the resurgence of old-time German utopian socialism, which was now spreading. There had come also a chimerical game with the future of society, although in a more futile form than in its previous manifestations, and thus was one not deserving of comparison with the great French and English utopians, but only, of course, with Vitling. It seems that the fallen tailor and the long-departed Heine had been much on Marx's mind lately, although they hadn't been at odds with each other out of joint with their time. And so had Marx been out of joint with his time, and always would be, no matter what time it was. To his communist correspondent in the frozen Hoboken garden in his letter, which had come to him by no miraculous means but by mail packet, funnels blowing trails of crackling, hissing steam like snow clouds. Marx had pointed out, what seemed natural to him, that the utopianism that before the age of materialistic critical socialism had concealed the latter within itself in nuce, in a nutshell, and which was coming now post festum, after the event, could only be silly, stale, and basically reactionary. Among the time-old manuscripts that had been left by the bankrupt revolutionary Wittling in his last estate were his sheaves of tattered and torn prison poems, socialist poems, workers' poems, poems replete with the love for mother and child, which had been psychologically so great in the bosom of this bastard wanderer that he had refused to publish in any financially failing sheet bearing his millennial imprint the paying advertisements of embryo killers. Also a poem which should have qualified him... Which had been psychologically so great in the bosom of this bastard wanderer that he had refused to publish in any financially failing sheet bearing his millennial imprint, the paying advertisements of embryo killers. Also a poem... I still don't know what that means. Also a poem which should have qualified him for publication in journals of sentiment in an age which must have been produced from its start to its finish 1,200 tons of rose poems and which seemed particularly to lean toward those with expressed lost love, lost lovers, lost sweethearts, was that which told of a beautiful maiden who plucked a rose and placed it upon her lovely breast, where fated as her banished lover yearned to share the same fate. It seemed that he would die for love. Life's dream was farewell to a loved one forever lost. So he wrote poems, and I guess he did not, he didn't want to publish them. I still don't know what that one sentence means. So that he could have been published in journals, but that he didn't want them published. Well, it probably was after his death. Okay, well, that's confusing. All right, so now we're on part two. Harp Song for Radical 45. We have to remember reading this, that this was considered... Young considered this to be a three-volume series, which she was never managed to finish in her life. So, I'm reading ahead to see how this ends. And it ends with a question, which is typical Young. So, yeah. So I think that's why we have, although I find it informative and important, I think part two we're finally going to get into, back into Debs. So yeah, 45 starts with Daniel Debs. So let me see. Yeah. So I think we're going to now get into Debs, but I know we take a detour with Lincoln. And Mrs. Lincoln, oddly enough. So that's going to be interesting. And then back into Debs. So yeah, I think we have to keep in mind that there's a ton of history here, and that... this originally had planned to be a three-volume series, which sadly she was not able to finish. But I can say we're about almost a quarter of the way through the book, too. Very interesting. So, of course, stuff happens. And since this is taking place in real time with real events, that critical thinking skills are necessary. I understand people want to be reactive and get upset and is steeped in the Old Testament of an eye for an eye. But we have to we have to have critical thinking skills. We always have to be able to look at something and say, Why? Why? Why did that happen now? Why not later? Why did that happen at that time? Who had the most to gain? Why? And I think if you look at why, there's a lot more information that can be had to help you look at things. To look at things in a way that can be fixed. Right now, there's no looking at things in a way that it can be fixed. Sadly enough. And I've pulled back from, again, if you're reading along with Paper Pills, absolutely seek her out. She does a great job promoting literature in general, and she's been really helpful with Young. I, however, am pulling back. So I'm pulling back from everything, any involvement. Not for any particular reason, not because of something bad that was done to me, not because of anything like that. Just to for there's no perspective there, and there's no ability to sit down and talk and come up with those whys. Or come up with those, ask the questions why and get in, and even if you, not that you get an answer, but just some kind of thinking behind it. So, well, if all goes well, we'll finish this Harp Song for a Radical, and then until I hear differently, hopefully that Miss McIntosh, My Darling, comes out again. And I don't know, I've written a lot of it. I don't know. I'm not sure if I should podcast it again. I'm looking forward to going back over it just with everything that's happened. Like, I've been able to read all of Young's work, and I think all of it informed it. She was not wrong, and she definitely described her work. Everything plays into another. She's just, you know, done one theme her whole life, her whole writing career. She was looking at one thing. And so for me, it just seems like there's still something else to go to get to look at after reading through everything now. Now I finished reading all of her books. I finished spending 4 years just on Miss McIntosh, My Darling. So for me, I still feel a need to go through it one more time with all the information that I have now. You know, like, you know, somebody with scholarly instincts or a scholarly job could do for a writer. That's not unheard of. But yeah. So, interesting. Like I said, I'm done living in interesting times. And it's a beautiful day out, even though it's cold. But thank you for listening. Hope you're well wherever you are. Hope you're safe. Enjoy yourself. Bye.